Hello and welcome back to the Dune Minute podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
Today we are joined by a very, very special friend and guest and friend of the show, David from the Lorehounds. Hey, David.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me on. This is, I'm really excited. This is fun.
You're in our world now.
Man, prepping this minute by minute thing was... It was hard. The discipline is, you know,
it's a different beast.
I really give it to you guys for having the discipline of it is cutting off and like when there's a line cut and that's it. And I was doing my notes all in one document and then as I'm jumping clips, I'm like, oh, no. I have to put this whole thing down into this other section because he doesn't complete the sentence in this one. So it's pretty hilarious. Yeah.
Gotta love those mid-sentence cutoffs and everything. And
exactly.
You know, the fun ones are the mid-word cutoffs.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's just like, my ha! It's like, oh, all right. Well, guess we'll find out tomorrow.
Well, I'm excited to be here, and I think we picked a good one for me to be on. So lots of depth and lots of lore to be able to bring into this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about this week. So
we are... Diving into this week, we are talking about minute 40 through 41 today, and this minute starts really exciting, and it ends super depressing. It ends on a real bummer of a note that we'll get to.
Can I interject something really quick before we start getting into the minute? As I was listening, of course I'm a regular listener to your podcast, and a couple of weeks ago, you guys were talking about the whole issue around... the changes that need to be made on screen versus the changes in like if it's a literary adaptation. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's not a problem. It's just something that happens, right? Whenever there's adapted works. And when we were back in a long time ago, when we were first covering Rings of Power season one, we came across this thing that we call now the Shippey test. And that's named for Tom Shippey, who is a very famous and well-known Tolkien scholar, and he's consulted with the Tolkien estate and with Jackson and with the Rings of Power folks. And back in February of 2010, he gave a lecture at Swarthmore College, which is in Pennsylvania, on the topic was Tolkien, Book to Jackson Script, The Medium and the Message. And if you search for that, you can find the Swarthmore page. It has the audio transcript and there's a recording, so you can actually hear his presentation given. And what he does is he specifically breaks down this whole topic of doing literary adaptations from page to screen. And he comes up with this central conceit, which is not necessarily unique because we all kind of get there in the end, but he is he's framed it in a way, and then we've taken it even further and just call it a test. We have several little funky tests that we, you know, things that we judge things by. We have a relative violence rating scale. We have something, does it fall within the genre or if it's a sequel, does it belong as a sequel or does it adapt too far off? Anyway, with the Shippey test, he talks about this thing, the medium and the message, so that somebody who's doing the adaptation, there is an original intent of the author that is trying to be delivered. And obviously, and like say with Lord of the Rings movies, so in the Jackson movies, there's this whole scene with Gandalf. And I can't remember if he's talking to Merry or Pippin, but he's talking about sailing to Valinor and the Undying Lands and seeing the rains and the mists part. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is described in the books as Frodo telling us that. I believe it's Frodo. Oh, I'm going to get in trouble there too. Anyway, we're going to leave that one in. And but they it didn't make sense to do it that way in the movies, and so they moved it to Gandalf delivering the lines when they're sort of at the big battle. And it's a good illustration because the intent, the message that the original author wanted to deliver was delivered.
Yeah.
But the change for the medium made sense. Now, sometimes you can change something or redact something or remove something, and it muddies or garbles the original intent. Right. And so, or they can inject a whole new stuff, right? That's a whole other thing. So we say, does it pass a shippy test? Did the original intent fall within was the medium change, the change for the on-screen adaptation still true to the original intent mm-hmm. of the author? And again, yeah. like I said, a lot of people have figured this kind of thing out. We just have a framework for it now. We can just say, oh, did it pass the shippy test or not? So gotcha. Yeah, I remember you guys had talked about it for quite a while, and they're like, oh, I should mention this to them. Because yeah. there is a whole conversation around it, and this guy, Tom Shippy, was able to finally put words around something that we all, a phenomenon that all of us in this sort of podcasting cottage industry run across.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think so far with Dune Part 2, I think it's doing fine in regards to that. Uh-huh. There are definitely some changes from the books, and we'll talk about a number of them this week. But when you start thinking about just the intent is still very mm-hmm. much there. So,
yeah, exactly.
We call them out just because that's, you know, going minute by minute, we have to call them out, but you know,
that's what we do.
Yep, it is.
And sometimes it can open up new conversation and new yeah. insights.
Yeah,
and absolutely. It also, and looking at the decisions that Villeneuve, say, you know, Denis Villeneuve is on this side, because he's interpreting the work, right? He is, yeah. he's bringing his own point of view, and he's very explicit about that. This is my movie. I love this property, and this is what I'm saying, not, yeah, so that's fair. I like the fact that Villeneuve recognizes his own bias and is open about that. I'm portraying yeah. it this way because that's the way I feel about it. Not that I'm not trying to do an honest rendition or a beat for beat rendition. I'm interpreting right. it and telling you my vision of it.
Right. Did you ever see the documentary on Jodorowsky's Dune?
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
that shit is wild.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking at about a particular part towards the end where Jodorowsky was saying, like, I won't repeat exactly what he's saying because it's pretty vulgar, but
right.
he's basically saying, I was going to take this story in a completely different direction. I was going to make it nothing like the original material at all. So in that regard, would that have failed or passed? I'm assuming failed. Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of, it can be, yeah, it, you know, there can be degrees of variation as yeah. well with this. So, but yeah, Jodorowsky, if he had ever made that, boy, I don't know what kind of world we would have been living in.
It would have looked good.
Yeah, it was wild, absolutely wild.
Cool. Well, let's get into this minute. Let's talk about it because we got some fun stuff to get to. So, like I said, we were talking about minute 40 through 41. Starts exciting, ends kind of depressing. And right off the bat, we are getting the explosions that we left off with last week. So we get about 3 seconds or so of the Harkin, oh no, more than 3 seconds, but we get the harvester continuing to explode from the laser gun bazooka attack.
We conveniently see Chaul do a dive over the top of that dune they oh so conveniently teleported to yeah. after taking down the ornithopter from the end of last week's episodes and everything. People are just really good at, you know, late to the second speed running across deserts in this movie.
Yeah.
It's, hey, Spice gives you speed.
I guess so. I think, David, the biggest offender of this that we've seen so far is Jessica getting to the top of the dune to hit that Harkonnen with the rock.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It was, yeah. A couple weeks ago, but that was the one that just took me out of took me out of my suspension of disbelief. And I was like, how the hell did she get up there so fast?
And it's funny because in the flow of the movie, you're not necessarily going to notice that, no. but when you're breaking down minute to minute, and I noticed that in this minute, I was like, oh my God, I never really thought about them rolling down that hill.
Yeah.
But the thing that I noticed about it is, as the carryall starts to sort of burst out and with its big internal detonation, mm-hmm. they also explode over the line of the ridge. So those two movements, or that special effect in that and those actors moving, is synchronized so that you get a sense of the energy of the carryall exploding. But then what I thought was really interesting was as they roll down the hill and come to a kind of a stop in the valley, that's when they cut scenes to the older Fedaiken who's raising his hands going, ha ha. Mm-hmm. And so that the relative motion, the energy between scenes is carried, it's preserved. Yeah. And so we are psychologically going from the explosion into the celebration in the tent. And the movements of Paul and Shawnee rolling are tied to the movement of the Fedaiken, who's, you know, punctuating a moment with his hands in the air.
Yeah.
And then we go from that very bright of the desert to the very dark of the tent. So that also conveys time, like mm-hmm. we are now, you know, well after. So really good, efficient visual storytelling. And then there's the sound effects as well, the explosion of the carryall to the explosion of the celebration.
Yeah.
So from, you know, movies and TVs are made in the editing bays, mm-hmm. right? You know, they're shot somewhere, but they really they're crafted. The rough stone is hewn out, right? But then that's like a jeweler sitting there with a fine tool is in the editing bay. And so I really liked the transition of the carryall exploding to the being in the tent. It was super right. efficient.
Yep.
You're riding two different highs at that point. You know, mm-hmm. the high of the adrenaline of the explosions and everything, and you have that one component of the harvester, which like explodes out in the background and also does its own yes. somersault through yeah, the desert yeah, and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
To then the high of like everyone's celebrating, you're partying, it's a good time. However, the Fremen don't really seem to have good dental.
Would they?
You know, I would hope that they have decent benefits, but
well, when you're sucking on spice laced Slim Jims all day, I was like,
fair enough.
maybe spices. Maybe they don't put fluoride in the drinking water. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe we shouldn't talk about that topic. That's a that's a touchy one.
It's taking your precious bodily fluids.
That's right.
I honestly thought, I thought that was a. I thought it was a stogie in Paul's mouth at first. Mm-hmm. When I first saw it, I was like, is he smoking a cigar right there? but no, it is the Slim Jim, the spice Slim Jim, I guess we can call it.
Can we add that to your canon now?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely, we can.
we got PB&Js. We got to have some spice Slim Jims. So.
It looks delicious. I would love to try one of those.
Yeah, I didn't know if they were doing a hookah or what. And then, like, of course... rewatching and rewatching the minute yeah. over and over again, mm-hmm. I did pick up on the fact that it's some little stick. And yeah. I actually pulled the screenplay for Dune Part mm-hmm. 2 to be able to pull some stuff, especially a couple of names of people. So yeah, it says there that it's a spice stick in the screenplay. So
I
don't know if they could get the Slim Jim sponsorship for that scene or whatever. So.
Exactly.
Maybe they just didn't want to pay the product placement fees or what have you.
I do love, too, this when they cut to the exterior of the tent. And this really made me think about the of the visual adaptations that we have for Dune. I really am appreciating Villeneuve's point of view in giving us something that looks very relatable to us in our primary world here, but also making it look unique at the same yeah. time. And so, yeah, we get the exterior shot. It's nighttime. We get it. But and we're like, wait, where are they? What are they doing? And then we see this cool group tent set up.
Yeah.
And I just love the way that Villeneuve treats the Fremen culture. In the book, we have a much narrower point of view. In 84, obviously, it's mm-hmm. a very different movie. I love 84, so don't get me wrong. I still have not seen the miniseries. But the attention that Villeneuve pays to the culture and the technology and making it, it really, to me, honors what Frank was doing originally in terms of his own research and understanding of things. And so I really appreciate it. One of the things I also loved was the... Jameis's burial ceremony as if it yeah. were or burial his you know the reclamation ceremony taking yep. it was just beautiful and the attention to detail. And so again, the setup of this tent, it feels very grounded and real mm-hmm. at the same time being very Fremen and Arrakeen.
Yeah
well art Art and Soul of Dune has some things to say about the tent. So you're looking into my notes already.
Ah, perfect. Well, I can see it. I can see where you're going to go with your podcasting. I'm prescient.
Yeah. So one of the things that it talks about is how in part one, you know, the still tents were very designed around the shape of a cockroach. Whereas mm-hmm. here in part two for this communal tent, they were actually inspired by lice, which I think is a weird way of putting it. But that's what, you know, the authors of The Art and Soul of Dune have to say mm-hmm. in terms of the inspiration and everything, which I think is an interesting way of going about doing it. But, you know, they're, you know, made of fabric and metal frames. And if you look at the big tent as a whole, it kind of has a bug-like shape to it, which is strange yeah. because the visual language for bugs in this movie is very Harkonnen coded, but you have that central body with a long tube,
mm-hmm.
you know, that reaches out to the other end. And from that central body of the tent, you have six smaller ones that kind of protrude outward.
Interesting.
Almost like smaller, like sleeping pods or whatever.
Okay.
So it's a very interesting design. But one thing that I felt was notably different in this one compared to the one in Dune Part 1 was that, and there's a lot of reasons why they would symbolize the still tent in Dune Part 1 to look this way. But in Part 1, it was very reminiscent, and Art and Soul for Part 1 even states this, very reminiscent of a womb.
Interesting.
But at that point, you know, we're talking about Paul's essential, I don't want to use the word ascension, but his ascension after his first huge hit of spice.
Yeah.
And he's having his first like major moments of prescience and everything. So mm-hmm. there's obviously some visual motifs that they want to hit with that, you know, womb appearance and everything from there. But the interior of this tent, we have a lot of people inside. They're all celebrating, you know, there's everything from pantomiming like what they were doing
in the
fight. Our favorite yeah. white bearded Fremen
is
doing his little you know, acting out the fight and everything. But then we also have some Fremen on the outside when we have that exterior shot where there's nine of them huddled around these thermal lamps. And
mm-hmm.
the thermal lamps were a design that Denis wanted, so that way they're not setting fires in the middle of the desert.
Right.
And
right.
you can quickly shut off a thermal lamp and hide if you need to, much faster than you can a fire. And that was their inspiration for the creation of those devices.
Nice. Makes Let sense. Alone carrying fuel, wood, and smoke and all
exactly.
that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, too, it makes sense because, and it plays with the idea of Muad'Dib, which we'll get into later, but where would you take your design inspiration from? You take it from your natural world. That's a very mm-hmm. sort of normal human thing to do. And so that there is some structural elements that are translated from insect life, which is adaptable and surviving in this harsh environment. It makes sense that a culture would seek that inspiration from those sources.
Yeah. I think a lot of the Fremen technology is done in that same way. I'm thinking of the wind traps, being modeled after Muad'Dib's ears. They take those cues from nature.
Or even going back to Herbert and ornithopters, like mm-hmm. we don't know what. I don't know that we know that. This may be a place where I'm ignorant of, but do we know what Herbert was actually trying to get? Because from the minimal book descriptions, it sounds pretty like we're like, wait a minute, how would that work? But again, I love the way that Denis has interpreted that. So
yeah, because I mean, they look super dragonfly like in this movie. Mm-hmm. They are basically boxes in the 84 movie.
84, right? Like, we can't even talk about it. Like, what Lynch did.
Yeah,
he was like, I don't know, it's a box, it looks like a bird box, right? We're done.
And I'm trying to remember what they are in the miniseries.
Yeah. Anyway, I love all of Villeneuve's interpretation.
Yeah.
And then speaking of Villeneuve and editing too, something I learned, I knew what a J cut was,
mm-hmm.
and that's where audio and video bleed. But I didn't know there was an L cut, and an L cut is where the audio from the preceding scene overlaps further into the under scene or the next scene. It's the opposite of the J cut. So one is the tail, one is a head sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I love hearing Stilgar talking then while we have Shishakli and Chani and Paul in frame.
Yeah.
So visually we have those three together, and then we have Stilgar talking underneath them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are always really good for just carrying you from one scene to the next. It's a perfect way of just, you know, I mean, transitioning into the next conversation in this case.
Specifically, because of course Stilgar is speaking in Chakobza here, what he's saying as translation is, you saw what he did. He saw it coming. He saved her life. He saw it. He can foresee.
Just like again, I can foresee into your script notes.
Once again, you know, Stilgar is just on his, you know, Lizan al-Gaib train, and he's just going through. But one thing that I thought was very noticeable was that, you know, Stilgar in his, I'm going to use the wrong word here, but it's the one that just, I think, makes the most sense. Stilgar and his acolytes here have historically always been older people. But if you look, and because we're watching this minute by minute, going second by second, if you look in the background, there's a lot more younger people that are starting to huddle up with Stilgar as he's doing his, you know, you saw what he did. He saw it coming. His, like, his Lizan al-Gaib glazing, for a lack of a better term. So it's interesting to see that there's more people kind of coming into this fold. And unless you're really paying attention, I think you're going to miss that.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting with Shishakli, who... Okay, now I got to bring something else in that I just learned from Alicia because we're covering Andor right now. There is a Star Wars term that is now being used a little bit more wider and wider. It's called Glubshito. Okay. And it's a minor character that's important but is still tertiary to the thing. And so it's a funny thing. So
gotcha.
So say Shishakli again.
Shishakli.
She's a Glubshito, which is a really important character, but is, you don't get much backstory to or what have you. But this is the moment that she is now beginning to commit herself to Paul.
Yeah.
And she's really skeptical prior to this, but ultimately we know that, you know, her ending fate, you know, in becoming a martyr. But this is the moment where she turns and begins to start her journey in martyrdom, as it were. But she is a young person who was doubting. And then now this is that look on her face is the moment where she begins this new journey. Interestingly, I guess in the books, the same character was a man and was the person who gave the maker's hooks to Paul.
Yeah.
And that's all they did in the book too, because Denis goes so far as to say, like, this was a super minor character, you know, but we wanted to give Chani kind of a sounding board to go off of for a lot of Chani's doubts that they were writing into the movie and everything.
Yeah. And I think they really beautifully brought her volume up as a character, rather than here's some maker hooks, Muad'Dib, to like you were saying, Zach, that this is the stand in for the youth coming over from the olds, who are, you know, oh, he's prescient. He can see, you know, like the whole Lizan al-Gaib gig.
Yeah. And we see Shishakli earlier in the movie, I mean, she's like actively antagonistic towards Paul. Like she is, she's like angry and kind of rude to him. But now she's, you know, she's playing around with him. She's joking. She's doing a little mouse movement on his shoulder, which is the next thing we see in this minute here. She you know, puts her hand on his shoulder and mimics the mouse. And she goes, Muad'Dib likes his smell.
Which is then great setup for when we get, you know, into the next couple of minutes here. Yeah. So,
and this is the first time that we hear the term Muad'Dib in the Denis Villeneuve movies. I'm At least I'm pretty sure it is. I did also pull up the scripts and just do my control F search for the term, and I didn't see it in there at all. So I believe this is the first time we get a name to the desert mouse that we've seen a few times already.
And we'll have to talk about Muad'Dib in later minutes. Yes. We got notes though, right?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Well, and all we saw of Muad'Dib in the first movie was just when Paul emerged from the cell tent and he like looks at Muad'Dib and the Muad'Dib just like fucks off because Duncan appears in his ornithopter at that point. So
yeah.
Paul didn't really have much of a chance to interact with it beyond just looking at it.
Right. Not unlike Han coming to find Luke it's when the other rebel pilots find Han and Luke on Hoth. Sorry. Lucas, I don't know if Lucas took direct inspiration, but it's I feel those two scenes rhyme. So sorry, I've got Star Wars on my brain right now because of Andor.
Well, you know, this a lot of Dune is pulled, or sorry, a lot of Star Wars is pulled from Dune. So.
I was going to say you switched that real quick.
I thought what was interesting too is where Chani was. She's kind of giving Paul a nice. She's like, oh, all right, all right. I mean, it's kind of hot to blow an ornithopter out of the sky to protect your, you know, your crush, right? Right? Well, it's kind of hot. You did that for me.
You have to do those you know grand gestures in the Fremen culture. You know, it can't just bringing you flowers or anything like that.
No, I want a Harkonnen ornithopter.
Yeah,
I don't want. Yeah, flowers is a waste of water, bro.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Bring me some Harkonnen bodies so that we can, you know, use their water for
yeah, well, add them to the cistern.
Yes, yeah, not drinking water, but for utility water.
Exactly. So, Shishkali says Muad'Dib likes his smell, and when I was thinking about this line, I kind of got the insinuation, and maybe this was obvious to everyone except me, but Paul was the person underneath the sand that the mouse ran up to the breathing tube earlier, and who we heard say go away. Did any of y'all like catch on to that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'm just late to the party then. That's fine.
I'm pretty sure I mentioned that during last week's episode.
That was so long ago, man. That was ancient history at this point.
Well, I think this gets too into the whole shippy test of it all, is that Villeneuve is not giving us a lot of prescience of Paul as we get in 84 or in the book, and that we get introduced to Muad'Dib through Paul's visions, where here Villeneuve gives us the real Muad'Dib and then has to tie it. I think it's elegantly done. You know, you can argue with the question about prescience and did we see enough of Paul's prescience on screen to really talk, you know, to really get a sense of the trap that Paul feels himself in between the, you know, bloody jihad, the global, you know, the galaxy spanning jihad and just trying to survive as a family, all, you know, the whole moral dilemma that he's under. And then the fact that we're looking at power corrupts kind of question and outside saviors and the missionary protectiva and, you know, all of that stuff, the manipulation, cultural manipulations and stuff.
Yeah.
But he has to link Muad'Dib to Paul, and with the seeing the mouse in the earlier scenes, then seeing the mouse. So first we understand that, oh, there's a little desert mouse and we see it making its own moisture, sweating, you know, whatever. And then we connect it to Paul, and then Shishkali then connects it to the next step, which then Paul can use it when he's talking to Stilgar in a couple of minutes here. So I think from a storytelling standpoint, if you're going to take the prescience quotient out, then Villeneuve has established what Muad'Dib is and why it's such an important name.
Yep. Agreed. So Chani moves along and she looks at Paul, and you're right. She does kind of have like doe eyes when she's looking at him. She goes, who taught you to fight like that? And this is where Paul kind of becomes a wet blanket on the party. he goes, my old masters, they were close friends. And then he looks down. He says, they were massacred alongside my father.
I love that in this moment, Shishkali just gives Stilgar a "is this guy fucking like serious" look. she's like, "this motherfucker just ruined the party." God damn it.
And I think it opens up an interesting historical question too, because Paul says, "you've been fighting them for decades," and now, you know, the next line finishes it, and to establish the time scale. But here it starts to open up, even if he's just saying, and I'm trying to be disciplined about not completing the line, but he says fighting for decades, which implies the implication and the next following sentence has to imply that he has a different level of authority. He understands something greater than they understand. That's the implication of the statement. And that, I think, opens up the deep history of the Atreides and Harkonnen relationship, which then we see in Dune Prophecy, you know, on the television show, where other people have decided to interpret this.
And that is where the minute ends. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades, and I think the last words we get as the clock rolls over to the next minute is "my family," and then it stops right there.
It doesn't even finish "family." It's just "my fat."
Well, I gave it a little bit of courtesy. We'll finish the word. I think we established that earlier in this movie, because the cuts are not as clean as they were in the first movie. So if they start the word, we'll say the word. Cool. I don't think I have any more like notes straight from the books. I mean, this scene doesn't necessarily happen in the books. I mean, we get hints of it, or at least the conversation that we've heard up until this point doesn't happen. So I will have a lot more to say about the actual dialogue in the books, I believe, starting tomorrow.
Yep. Art and Soul doesn't really have anything else for us, at least to talk about just yet, other than the fact that the exterior scenes for all of this were shot in the UAE. And they were doing their shoots either like directly before sunup or directly after sundown, just like they had done with part one. And we had talked about that a lot during the first season as well. But all of the interior shots were done at the sound stages in Budapest. But Zach, there's one thing that we missed that I think is super important, and that there's coffee service right now.
It wasn't missed. Trust me,
Stilgar is making coffee just for you, and you're just gonna tell him no.
Yeah, that's, man. I don't drive with spice coffee. That's not my thing,
bro. When you mix a spice Slim Jim with the coffee, the flavors intermingle perfectly. The spice acts as the bridge between the two profiles, from the acidity of the coffee and the spit to the sumptuousness of the protein.
Yeah, breakfast of champions, I guess. I didn't miss it, John. I saw it, and I just didn't say it anything about it because I didn't want to bring it up.
Right, you were trying to obfuscate and just move on. And the minute's over. The minute's over. Come on.
Yeah. And to that point, the minute is over.
Good deal. Well, John, you want to take us out with some socials? And we will get back tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. As always, you can find us online. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com as well. David, I know the Lorehounds has a few different places that they can be found, so anyone that is listening to this that is not already a Lorehounds fan, because I know we've picked up a few of y'all's fans as well throughout our Prophecy coverage and everything, do you mind plugging where people can find you guys?
Sure. Yeah, you can find the Lorehounds on your podcast player of choice just by doing Lorehounds. We've got a bunch of other feeder feeds as well for different properties that we're covering, but if you want the fire hose, it's all at the Lorehounds. And we have a community Discord that is a lively and fun place. We've got channels and everything set up for all the different properties and episodes that we're covering. And then we're also on Blue Sky, and you can just find us at the Lorehounds. And Alicia and John and I are all individually linked in the bio there. And I think our Blue Sky also has our link tree, which has links to all of the other affiliate podcasts that we sponsor specifically. I don't know. One of these days we have to form an alliance amongst all of our other friends, because we you guys, Captain's Pod, every single sci-fi film ever. Yeah, we've got a fun little constellation.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Well, as always, it's always a great time talking with you and everything. And for those that are listening, there's going to be plenty more of David this week. We've got a lot to talk about. So we will see you on tomorrow's episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you later.
See ya.